So from chapter 4, verses 1 to 11. Next, Jesus was taken into the wild by the Spirit for the test. The devil was ready to give it. Jesus prepared for the test by fasting 40 days and 40 nights. That left him, of course, in a state of extreme hunger, which the devil took advantage of in the first test. Since you are God's son, speak the word that will turn these stones into loaves of bread. Jesus answered by quoting Deuteronomy, "It takes more than bread to stay alive. It takes a steady stream of words from God's mouth." For the second test, the devil took him to the holy city. He sat him on top of the temple and said, "Since you are God's son, jump." The devil goaded him by quoting Psalm 91. "He has placed you in the care of angels. They will catch you so that you won't so much as stub your toe on a stone." Jesus countered with another citation from Deuteronomy. "Don't you dare test the Lord your God." For the third test, the devil took him to the peak of a huge mountain. He gestured expansively, pointing out all the earth's kingdoms, how glorious they all were. Then he said, "They're yours, lock, stock, and barrel. Just go down on your knees and worship me, and they're yours." Jesus' refusal was curt. "Beat it, Satan." He backed his rebuke with a third quotation from Deuteronomy. "Worship the Lord your God and only him. Serve him with absolute single-mindedness." The test was over. The devil left, and in his place, angels came and took care of Jesus' needs. And this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
For those of you who don't know me, a short introduction. My name is Brendan. That's enough. No. I'm a priest in the Anglican Church, but I don't work in this parish. My day job is working over the river down at the military camp in Linton, where I minister as a army chaplain. So I've got some stories to share from that for you today. Now, I don't know about any of you, but I really enjoy watching the Olympics, and I found it really hard this morning to tear myself away because it was the gold medal match of men's curling. Does anyone else like curling? I love watching curling. I don't watch it any other time of the year, but during the Olympics. For those of you who don't know what curling is, it's like lawn bowls, but on ice with brooms. I don't know how else to explain it. I really like watching the Olympics, or actually lots of different sports. But I don't know if you've ever tried to start playing a sport that you've watched on TV. My son and I recently decided to sign up for an archery class, and I love watching Olympics archery as well during the Summer Olympics. And you watch those athletes stand there, pull it back, and then release it, and the arrow just goes. And straight away, it's on the bullseye, and you're like, "Ah, that looks easy. I wouldn't mind giving that a go." It's not. Going along and trying for myself at even just 7 meters, not 70 meters. Very hard to get an arrow on target accurately again and again. It takes a lot of training, a lot of practice and consistency. And this is the same for basically anything like that you see. What we see as the end result is just the end result. There's so much work that goes in beforehand that leads to that point. As Will said, we are in the season of Lent now. Lent, for those of you who don't know, is a 40-day-ish, 7-week period in the church calendar in the lead-up to Easter. It's not quite 40 days because it's 40 days minus Sundays. So Lent begins on Ash Wednesday. The day before that is Shrove Tuesday. And then there's 7 weeks of fasting and preparation before we reach Easter. We don't fast on the Sundays because that's when Jesus is with us and we're celebrating it. A few years, so the tradition is that you'd normally choose something to give up. Historically, people would give up things like egg, flour, milk, which is why some of you who like doing things on social media might have seen a number of things about Pancake Day in the last week. In European countries, they often celebrate Shrove Tuesday by using up all of those dry ingredients, the eggs, flour, and making pancakes, and celebrating on the Tuesday before they start the fast on the Wednesday. And then you won't consume that up to Easter, except on Sundays. So why do we do Lent? Lent is a part of our church calendar where we prepare ourselves for Easter when we remember again what Jesus did by sacrificing himself, by dying on the cross to reconcile us with God. It is a time of preparation for us. But it's also, it can also be a reminder for us about something bigger going on in our lives. If we just do the same thing every year, it can actually start to lose a bit of meaning for us. If we love the church calendar, we ride the ups and downs. It's a beautiful thing to shape our lives with. But also there's an element of it that we might miss, an element of what we can learn from Lent and what the challenge that Lent might have for us. We can miss that if we just think about we'll do this every year. So today I want us to think both about preparation in terms of the annual calendar, but also preparation in terms of the bigger sense of what is it that we are preparing to do? What is it that we are preparing to do in our ministry and our fellowship, in our following of God and our discipleship? So, into the reading, and like Will said, I'm not preaching from the message. Slightly awkward though, because the message emphasizes Jesus's interaction with Satan, but it uses some different terminology, which doesn't quite sit well with the version that I read. And the key bit here is around testing. So the message kind of lumps everything into testing, whereas the NIV and other translations will talk about testing and temptation. So those are two different things that we'll tease out in a little bit. So where does today's reading fall in the Gospel of Matthew? It comes right at the start. We've had Jesus' genealogy, the story of his birth, story of John the Baptist, then Jesus is baptized, and then we get this. Jesus goes into the wilderness to be tempted, to be tested and tempted, and then he returns and then begins his earthly ministry. The reading has Jesus being led into the wilderness by the Spirit and then being tempted by Satan. And those are two very important things, because God will sometimes test, will put things in our lives for testing to help us refine what we're being called to do and understand that and just make sure we're on the right path. But God doesn't tempt us to sin. Those are very important distinctions for us to remember. Jesus goes into the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights, and one of the great understatements in the Bible, we're told that he was hungry. First temptation, because he was hungry, is Satan comes along and tempts him to do what? Turn stones into bread and eat, fix his hunger. Jesus responds, each time he responds to a temptation with a quote from Deuteronomy. There's two chapters that he's quoting from in particular, Deuteronomy 8 and Deuteronomy 6 for the second two. So Jesus tells him to, quotes Deuteronomy, says he's not going to do that. Satan then moves on, takes Jesus to the peak of the temple and says, throw yourself off and the angels will catch you. And Jesus says, again, a quote from Deuteronomy, says that he won't do it. And finally, the third temptation happens and Satan takes Jesus to the top of a mountain, shows him the kingdoms of the world and says that if Jesus worships Satan, he will give him those kingdoms. And Jesus says that he won't do that. And so finally, Satan leaves and the angels come and tend to Jesus. And then the story continues and Jesus begins his earthly ministry, calling disciples, transforming lives. So what are we to make of these temptations? What's actually going on here? The reason why this comes at this point and why we even have this story is to show the journey of Jesus into ministry, because it's actually really important for there to be a time of preparation before going into ministry, a time of deliberate testing to make sure that that preparation was actually good enough to enter into ministry. Can't just snap your fingers and suddenly go from woe to go. Jesus was baptized, the heavens open, this is my son with whom I'm well pleased. There needed to be a period of confirmation within Jesus and also as an example to others in the story that we have of him, of who is Jesus and what does that actually mean. So Jesus' baptism and the fasting in the wilderness and the temptation and passing that trial go hand in hand, both for Jesus' hearers in the story, to prove that Jesus is who he says that he is and he has the authority to follow through on that. I don't know about you, but I really don't like doing tests. Who likes doing tests? I'm seeing lots and lots of shaking of heads. So as I said, my day job is working in the military, and we love testing things. It's kind of a big part about what we do. Anything you can test, we test. And so I found myself yesterday having to show up at work on a Saturday to do a test. I had to do one of our fitness tests. I'm in the military, I wear uniform, so I've got to kind of maintain the same standards as everyone else. And this test is, it's a run. We have to run 2.4K in a stupid amount of time and then do as many press-ups. Now, the reason why I had to do this on a Saturday is because I did it a week ago and I failed. My run was fine, which normally is not, but I was fine for that, but I didn't do good enough on my press-ups. I did enough of them, but I didn't get deep enough. There's a whole thing that I'm not going to show you now because it'll be embarrassing. And the people at the back won't be able to see. But basically, you've got to make sure that your shoulder blades get below your elbow when you go down for the press up and then get back up. But I didn't. And the person assessing me last time was very mean and didn't give me an easy pass. So I had to go back and do it again. Testing is a way that we make sure that our preparation was good enough. I've learnt in the last few years that I can't just show up on the day and do a fitness test. I actually have to work at it. As you know, I get closer to 40 than I am to 30. Your body just doesn't work the same, and fitness doesn't work the same, and you've got to keep on investing in it. So there's nothing like a fitness test to tell you if the preparation that you've been doing, the work that you've been doing weekly, diligently trying to make sure that you keep that standard. The test is where you actually find out if it was good enough. And sometimes it wasn't. Sometimes you have to go back and try again. Now, in this instance, I passed yesterday because I did get deep enough. So it was fine. I was quite happy. But the same thing actually applies, I think, in our following of Jesus. We can be faithful, read our Bibles, pray, participate in fellowship, be disciples of Jesus, continue to prepare for the things that God is calling us to do. But sometimes we need to be tested. Sometimes we need to put that preparation to the test to know if we're ready for that next step, whatever the next thing that God is calling us to do. But I want to focus a little bit on now on the temptations that Jesus experienced, because there's a big warning for us in this as well. But I've got a question for you. When we think about these three temptations, the food, the temple, and the mountain, and the kingdoms, are they different temptations or are they the same temptation? I'm going to do a little hands-up exercise. Put your hands up if you think that it was three different temptations. Put your hands up if you... I see quite a few. Put your hands up if you think it was just one temptation. It's cheating. It's both. So on the surface, it does look like three quite different temptations, but hopefully as we tease them out, you'll see that actually all three of them are pointing to the same thing, the same underlying temptation that Jesus was dealing with. So in order for us to do that, I think we actually need to take ourselves out of our 21st century New Zealand mind and try and imagine what it would have been like for people actually hearing Jesus give this account at the time. Because let's be honest, Jesus would have probably told this story. Someone would have found out the story to share it. We're told that Jesus was in the wilderness by himself. So no one was there kind of watching him go through this misery. At some point, the story was shared. So what would the story have meant to the original hearers? We've got to think about kind of the symbology of it. When they heard these different parts of the stories, what would have been echoing in their minds? What would they have been thinking about? So the first one, food in the wilderness. What would they have been thinking about? What are some other examples from the Old Testament of food in the wilderness? Manna in the Exodus. Yeah, so Israelites had been brought out of slavery in Egypt, freed from that, meant to be moving into being, fulfilling the calling as God's people in the promised land. But as they went through the desert, they didn't have anything. And so God provided for them, provided food overnight that they could gather, but they could only gather enough for the day. They weren't allowed to store it up because they had to keep on trusting in God's provision. So, and the Deuteronomy passage kind of references this as well. So when Jesus' hearers would have heard Jesus in the wilderness for 40 days, you know, it's not 40 years like the Israelites spent in the Exodus, but that would have kind of meant Jesus' ministry would have taken a bit longer. When they heard the 40 days, when they heard the wilderness, when they heard the bread, they would have been thinking straight away, Exodus story. That's where their imaginations would have gone to. So what would have happened if Jesus had listened to Satan and given in to this temptation? Well, first of all, he wouldn't have been hungry anymore, which would have been a nice thing. But also, he would have turned his back on God's provision, on trusting in God, even when it was hard, even when it hurt. I don't know how many of you have experienced deep hunger. You know, I'm not talking about being hangry at 5 p.m. while you're waiting for dinner. I'm talking about you haven't eaten for days. Most of us, thankfully, don't have to experience that. But there's a certain all-encompassingness that comes with that sort of hunger. Life becomes about survival and finding your next bit of food. And here we have Jesus in the wilderness, hungry, fasting, not eating. And here is an option for him to fix that, to solve that problem. But he knows that he was called into the wilderness to fast, to test his preparation, to be ready to be the Messiah. And if he'd given in, if he did what Satan was telling him that he should do to fix his immediate problem, what he would have actually been doing was showing that he didn't trust in God's provision, that he didn't trust in God's goodness, that God was with him through that call. So it's not about being hungry at all. It's actually about trusting in God's call and provision, in God's goodness and God's plan. He would have decided that his way was better because of his immediate needs and fixed that. So what about the next temptation? Throwing himself off the temple. I'm not going to ask you any other stories where this might have happened in the Old Testament, because I don't think it does. But what it was the place of the temple in Israel. The temple was God's home. It was a center of their worship, the center of their religious life, but also the center of their civic life, as much as they could do that in Roman-occupied land. They didn't have the separation of kind of like we're used to of church and state. Everything was kind of merged into one in their mind, that they were meant to be God's people, ruled by God, and that was where God ruled from. And so by Satan taking him to the top of the temple, he's taking him to the very center of Israel's identity, of Israel's daily life together as a people. And then imagine if you're in that place of authority, and something that miraculous happened. He jumps off the tallest point and doesn't hurt himself because the angels protect him. How could anyone have doubted who Jesus was? How could anyone have asked any questions about him? They would have just, the rabbis, the chief priests, everyone would have just had to accept what he had to say, because obviously there would be something so special about who he was. But they would miss some of the point of what Jesus had come to do. Because actually all that would have done would have been to change Israel's blind obedience to the law, to blind obedience to Jesus, because obviously he is more powerful, but there wouldn't have been any relationship with him. their practice of their faith and working out of their faith wouldn't have changed at all. It just would have flipped from one thing to the next. And that's not what Jesus came to do. And so if Jesus had done what Satan challenged him to do, of throwing himself off and be saved, as an example, it would have probably converted a significant part of Israel then and there. Problem solved. That's Jesus doing what he was meant to do. But not really. Because actually, he would have missed the actual end point of transforming Israel's worship. It would have just redirected it. And so on the surface, it could feel like this is actually a really easy way to solve this problem of what Jesus was coming to do. But if he had followed through with what Satan did, if he'd given in to that temptation and taken that easy road out without the hardship of the 3 years of ministry and the failures that would have come with that, if he'd taken that path and given in to that temptation, all he would have done would be redirecting Israel's worship, and that would have actually, it wouldn't have meant anything in the long run. And finally, the third temptation, receive the kingdoms of the world if only he worships Satan. Well, first of all, I don't think the kingdoms of the world were Satan's to give in the first place. But what's going on with this temptation? What would it have achieved? If we think back to what Israel's purpose was, why did God choose Israel as his chosen people? It wasn't just for their own benefit. It wasn't just so that they could walk around smugly and be like, oh, we're more important than you because God's chosen us. It's kind of how it works sometimes, but that's not what they were actually called to do. They were called to be a nation of priests to the world. They were meant to be the ones that conveyed God's goodness and God's grace and God's love to the nations. They were meant to spread the good news about God to the nations instead of just being a nation in and of themselves that thought themselves more special than everyone else. And so when Satan offers the kingdoms of the world to Jesus, what he's actually offering is a shortcut to the end result of what Israel was meant to do and what we are meant to do as well. None of the hardship, none of the struggle, none of the challenges that come along with the way of dealing with people, of transforming lives, just here it is, take it. So it would have achieved, as far as Satan was concerned, Jesus' end result of what he wanted, which was all the nations to worship God. But actually the way that would have happened would have been completely counter to what God wanted, because God wanted lives and communities and peoples transformed by him and by worshipping him. So Satan is offering the easy route to get to where he thinks Jesus wants to go. Now I hope you see what I mean when I said all three of those temptations are different examples of the same underlying temptation. They're three examples of Satan offering Jesus the easy road, a quick shortcut that doesn't involve any sacrifice, doesn't involve any hardship, doesn't involve any struggling, but also doesn't involve any transformation in people's lives. Satan is offering Jesus the shortcut to where he thinks he should go instead of allowing Jesus to actually live out the thing that he's been preparing to do, which is transforming his disciples' lives and helping them to transform other people's lives through the kingdom of God. So what does that mean for us today? What are we meant to make of this? I think this means something for us as individuals, but then also there's something for us collectively as well. So for us as individuals, I don't know what it is that God has put on your heart. I don't know what it is that you feel is the thing that God is calling you to do. For some of you, you may still be searching. You may still be wondering, what is it? For others, you may already feel like you're living out of it, or you may be somewhere in between. But the challenge I think that we all have is, are we prepared enough? Have we tested that preparation well enough, or have we given in to the temptation to just try and shortcut it and get to that end result? Have we trusted in God's guidance and God's provision and God's process to prepare us for the ministry that he's calling us to? I know for me, that's something I've often struggled with. I'm quite an impatient person. I like things here and now. I don't like waiting. Waiting sucks. To the point where, you know, as I said, I'm a priest. I offered myself for ordination at a very young age. At 20, I thought it was a really good idea. I was like, oh yeah, I think God might be calling me to get ordained, so why not? I then found out that the Anglican Church doesn't ordain 20-year-olds. So I had to wait a few years. I then got ordained at 24, 25. So still very young for being a minister. But in that time, God did amazing things in my life. Did some awesome ministry work and saw God working incredibly in the lives of those that I was working with. But also I grew. I changed. The things that I had available to me to minister with and to share with others, that kete grew and expanded. So the preparation wasn't wasted. That waiting and that taking time wasn't wasted. But if I'd just been impatient and been allowed to get away with it, then, you know, I would have shortcutted that process, because it was hard initially being told no, being told we're going to wait, because I didn't like it. I wanted it now. But actually in that waiting, God works. In that preparation, God works. And the end result, I think, is so much more honoring to God. Not giving in to that temptation to just take what you think you should get here and now, and trusting in God's process is incredibly important. So like I said, I don't know what it is that God has put on your heart. But are you willing to wait and do the preparation? Test that preparation to make sure that you're ready. Or are you going to shortcut it and try and get to the end result? What about for us collectively, us as a faith community? What is it that God is calling us to do? You know, I looked at the website, being reminded about the vision that we have. Who wants to tell me what the vision is for the parish? Transformed. I'm waiting for one of the staff members to save me. So we as a community believe that we're meant to be here transforming lives, communities and cities. If that's what we feel called to do, if that's what we're going to do as a faith community, are we going to do the preparation for that? Are we going to make sure that when the time comes for us to do that, that we're actually ready? Or are we going to try and shortcut it and just kind of fix the end result? As I was sitting with this passage and kind of wrestling with this, an idea kept on coming up to me around Christendom. So for those of you who don't know, Christendom is kind of the big idea that captures basically European culture for a number of decades, that where European culture, and you know, New Zealand is an offshoot of that, was really controlled by Christianity. Christians and the church got to dictate life. We made all the rules. Not everyone went to church on Sunday, no shops were open, no one worked on Sunday. Society basically functioned by how we thought society would function. We controlled all of that during Christendom. We are now no longer in that world. We've lost a lot of that authority and a lot of that influence. And I actually think that's a good thing, because that's, control isn't what Jesus came to do. He didn't come to control people, he came to transform lives. And Christendom gave the church a shortcut. That was that temptation that Satan offered in practice. The church shortcutted transformation of lives and transformation of communities and transformation of cities to just controlling them, just dictating what the rules were. And so we can look back to Christendom and go, man, it would be so nice if we got back there, if everyone was just on the same page, if everyone just didn't program things on a Sunday, if everyone just came along to church. You know, if we were all just operating off the same base, we can look back at that and go, it would be so good if we could just regain that. But all we'd be doing is regaining the result of giving into that temptation. So when we talk about transforming a city, I think we need to be really careful to not be looking at trying to recover Christendom, where Christians dictated all the rules to everyone else. What we need to be thinking about is, how do we transform a city through just everyone believing and following Jesus with all of their heart, and then living that out in their daily lives? So it's not about creating the rules to enforce on other people, but it's about that personal transformation that leads to the collective transformation. So do we want to see that shortcut, or do we actually want to put in the hard yards, sacrifice, endure the hardship that comes with it to see true transformation come in the lives of those around us and those in our city? Let's pray. Lord, the challenge that we have before us is big. It's so easy for us to feel like that the things you're calling us to are insurmountable. So easy for us to try and find easy ways to get to that end result, Lord. But give us the strength, give us the courage to trust in you, to follow you, to trust in your leading and your guidance, to not try and achieve it in our own strength. Lord, and if we have given into that temptation in our own lives and collectively in our lives together, Lord, pray that we ask that you show us how we've failed in that way, how we've given into the temptation so we can repent of it, so we can return to you, so we can offer up those practices to you, so that we can continue to see your will be done in this place. So Lord, in this time of in this time of preparation, in this time of waiting, as we look to Easter, as we look to the things that you're calling us to, Lord, help us prepare well. Help us focus on you and follow your guidance. Amen.